The headlines: Iran says U.S. failure to give assurance about Tehran's enjoyment of full economic benefits from the 2015 nuclear deal is the main obstacle to its revival. Syria says Israel's nuclear activities pose a major threat to regional and international security, calling for comprehensive inspections of the regime's nuclear facilities. And Iraqi cleric Muqtada al-Sadr is demanding dissolution of parliament and new national elections, saying he is not interested in negotiating with his rivals. Hello everyone, thanks for tuning in to World News. Iran's UN ambassador says U.S. failure to give assurances on Tehran's enjoyment of full economic benefits from the 2015 deal is the main obstacle to its revival. Majid Takht Ravanchi made the remark in an address to the 10th Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty Review Conference. He says U.S. withdrawal from the deal back in May of 2018 and reimposition of unilateral sanctions prevented Iran's enjoyment of the deal's economic benefits. Iran's envoy said the country has been negotiating in goodwill with other parties to the deal to resume full implementation of the accord. Takht Ravanchi said Iran will return to that full implementation once the U.S. makes the right decision. Since the U.S. withdrawal, the remaining parties have held several rounds of talks to try to revive the accord. Talks have failed to make breakthroughs due to what Iran says the U.S. failure to show goodwill and its excessive demands. New round of talks is due to start in the Austrian capital. Iran's top negotiator Ali Bagheri Kani has called on the U.S. to seize the latest opportunity. Iran's defense ministry has displayed its various products during an exhibition in Tehran titled "The Defense Ministry's Capabilities in Knowledge-Based Production and Economy." Salman Kujuri reports.
Iran's defense ministry has held an exhibition on its capabilities in knowledge-based production and economy. The event covers such fields as transportation, health and medical equipment, security, energy, information and communication technology, cyberspace, construction and mining, industry, petrochemicals, food security and agriculture, as well as household appliances, electronic parts and geographic data and information. In general, 1,100 products in various fields have been put on display at the exhibition.
The ministry's management team has been cooperating with more than 6,000 knowledge-based companies. The localization of products, expanding in-depth knowledge and technology, and creating synergy among the relevant institutions are on the ministry's agenda. The Defense Ministry is responsible for empowering and upgrading Iran's defense industry capabilities while using its knowledge to contribute to production of non-military products.
Iran has repeatedly voiced its readiness to provide advanced scientific and military technologies to friendly and neighboring states, because it has already achieved self-sufficiency and scientific capabilities in the field of military power and manufacturing state-of-the-art weaponry.
Holding such exhibitions will provide an opportunity to learn more about the potential and capacities of the private, knowledge-based companies and make use of their potentials for defense-related productions.
Meanwhile, Iran's defense minister has announced that in the coming days, his ministry would unveil a series of new defensive achievements.
According to Iranian officials, as a result of cooperation between Iran's defense ministry and knowledge-based companies, the capacity of the ministry for production has increased by over 20 times in the past couple of years. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
Syria says Israel's nuclear facilities pose a major threat to regional and international security and must be subjected to comprehensive inspections by the UN nuclear agency. Bassam Sabah made the remark while addressing the 10th Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty Review Conference. He said Israel continues to refuse to join the Non-Proliferation Treaty due to unbridled support from the U.S. and Western allies. Sabah added Syria offered a resolution on making West Asia a nuclear-free zone in 2003, but it was blocked by Washington. Israel, which pursues a policy of deliberate ambiguity about its nuclear weapons, is estimated to have hundreds of nuclear warheads in its arsenal. The occupying entity has so far refused to either allow inspections of its military nuclear facilities or sign the non-proliferation treaty. Iraqi cleric Muqtada al-Sadr has demanded the country's parliament be dissolved in order to pave the way for holding new national elections. Sadr made the remark in a televised speech calling for a peaceful process leading to what he called democratic elections after the dissolution of parliament. He said most Iraqis are angry with the ruling class in its entirety. Sadr added that he has no interest in negotiating with his rivals. Since 5 days back, Sadr's supporters have been occupying parliament in protest of the nomination of Mohammed Shia al-Sudani as prime minister. According to Iraq's constitution, parliament can only be dissolved by a majority vote of lawmakers or by the prime minister after the president's approval. Now, Sadr's bloc emerged as the biggest faction from the last elections last October, but it was still far short of a majority. And then Sadr ordered his bloc 73 lawmakers to quit parliament in June after failing to nominate a prime minister. China slammed the United States' actions in Taiwan as extremely dangerous after U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi arrived in the island for a visit. The controversial visit has inflamed tensions between the superpowers. China says Taiwan is part of its territory. Now, the U.S. has announced the killing of al-Qaeda leader Ayman al-Zawahiri in a drone strike in Afghanistan, but the timing of his killing is somewhat questionable. After all, Zawahiri had been on the run for 20 years following the 9/11 attacks in the U.S., and now Washington has announced his killing just months after it withdrew forces from the country it had occupied. One must also not forget that the U.S., many say, was behind the creation of many extremist groups in the Middle East.
The United States says it has killed the al-Qaeda leader in Kabul, Afghanistan. Ayman al-Zawahiri has apparently been killed by a CIA drone strike over the weekend.
After carefully considering the clear and convincing evidence of his location, I authorized a precision strike that would remove him from the battlefield once and for all.
Biden claimed that no civilians were killed in the strike, but the U.S. is known for undercounting civilian casualties. Back in August 2021, the U.S. killed 10 civilians, including 7 children. Initially, the U.S. military claimed the strike killed ISIS-K members.
It was announced by the United States military that a drone strike in Kabul had killed ISIL operative who was getting ready, that they had caught him on the verge of another suicide attack at the airport. And then the United States was congratulating itself for saving lives. The story fell apart very quickly in the next few days. And even though the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Miley, called it a righteous strike, it turned out that this was a man named Samari Amari, who was a employee of a California-based NGO, humanitarian organization called Nutrition and Education.
Afghanistan's ruling Taliban group have confirmed the strike and described it as a violation of the country's sovereignty, but they have not commented on Zawahiri's death. Zawahiri was 71 years old when he was killed in the drone strike. His death is seen as the biggest blow to al-Qaeda since his former leader Osama bin Laden was killed by U.S. troops in Pakistan in 2011. He had apparently taken over the leadership of the group after bin Laden's death. Zawahiri grew up in Egypt and was a surgeon. He later joined bin Laden and is said to have masterminded the 9/11 attacks in the United States. Since 9/11 in 2001, he had been on the run and had a $25 million bounty on his head. Al-Qaeda has yet to issue a statement on his killing. Back in 2020, the United States signed an agreement with the Taliban in the Qatari capital, Doha. The agreement paved the way for the disastrous departure of U.S. troops from Afghanistan. Based on the agreement, the Taliban had promised not to allow the presence of terrorist elements on Afghanistan's territory. Now, the United States accused the group of violating that deal.
Now, there have been numerous reports about U.S. ties with former al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden. Some sources have said the CIA had direct ties with him and so-called Afghan Arab fighters. That's when the U.S. armed Mujahideen group to fight during the Soviet-Afghan War.
The U.S. invaded Afghanistan in 2001 following the 9/11 attacks. The aim of the mission was to root out al-Qaeda militants. The mission, which has lasted nearly 20 years, cost the lives of hundreds of thousands of Afghan civilians. The U.S.-Taliban deal showed that Washington failed to reach its objectives. But Afghanistan was the victim of hawkish U.S. politicians even before the 9/11 attacks.
Yes, well, the United States has been supporting terrorism. Al-Qaeda itself is an offshoot of outgrowth as the Taliban of U.S. support for insurgents who were resisting the Soviet invasion in 1979. This is our creation. Even Osama bin Laden himself was on the CIA payroll and was being praised by American presidents as a freedom fighter. So we have this history.
It's now a well-established fact that the United States helped create the al-Qaeda in the 1980s against the Soviets who had invaded Afghanistan. The operation to create al-Qaeda in Afghanistan was masterminded by the United States and financed by the Saudis. And the logistical work was carried out by Pakistan.
We also have a history of kind of moving in and out of Pakistan. I mean, let's remember here, the people we are fighting today, we funded 20 years ago. And we did it because we were locked in this struggle with the Soviet Union. They invaded Afghanistan. And we did not want to see them control Central Asia. And we went to work. And it was President Reagan, in partnership with the Congress, led by Democrats, who said, you know what? Sounds like a pretty good idea. Let's deal with the ISI and the Pakistani military. And let's go recruit these Mujahideen. And that's great. Let's get some to come from Saudi Arabia and other places, importing their Wahhabi brand of Islam, so that we can go beat the Soviet Union.
Leaked emails also show that Hillary Clinton, the then U.S. presidential candidate, was furious over the money channeled by Saudi Arabia and other Persian Gulf Arab countries to terrorist groups like al-Qaeda and the ISIL.
And now experts in nuclear weapons and technology have gathered for a forum in Seoul to discuss the potential crisis if Pyongyang conducts a seventh nuclear test and related issues this week. The Sejong Conference on Nonproliferation comes as the U.S. and South Korea are set to engage in the largest joint military drills on the Korean Peninsula in over 4 years. Our Seoul-based correspondent Frank Smith reports from Seoul.
Leading analysts gathered in Seoul, South Korea, and remotely from the United States to discuss North Korea's nuclear weapons program and the potential crisis should Pyongyang conduct a seventh nuclear test. Some admitted past strategies had failed and argued that North Korea's security concerns needed more attention and consideration.
We need to somehow address DPRK's strong motives for going nuclear. But what we did against DPRK was only strengthening DPRK's incentives to go nuclear.
North Korea suspended its nuclear and long-range missile testing following a 2018 summit between leader Kim Jong-un and former U.S. President Donald Trump. Now, years later, the U.S.-led sanctions Pyongyang had hoped to see removed remain in place. The discussion of North Korea's nuclear program comes as new South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol implements a more hardline approach to Pyongyang. President Yoon has called for the South's military to develop preemptive strike capabilities against the North as part of a so-called kill chain military strategy. President Yoon has also moved to restart suspended large-scale joint military exercises with the U.S., a move that Pyongyang has previously viewed as a provocation of war. The drills are scheduled to take place later this month. Meanwhile, many analysts believe such an approach will lead to greater tension.
The only way to address the risks of accident, misperception, or miscalculation is to try to manage deterrence through risk reduction. Limitations on military exercises, cessation of missile testing, force exclusion zones around the DMZ, sort of a mix of steps that both North Korea and South Korea and the United States would take in the conventional and strategic areas.
Experts also suggest a failure to reduce risks may encourage both South Korea and Japan to develop nuclear weapons themselves. Frank Smith, Seoul.
The first shipment of grain from Ukraine is now on its way to Lebanon following inspection in Turkish waters as part of a recent deal between Moscow and Kiev. Cargo was checked by Russian and Ukrainian representatives along with Turkish and UN officials. Ship laden with over 26,000 tons of corn left Ukraine's Odessa port on Monday. It's now on its way to the Lebanese port of Tripoli. 2 weeks ago, Russia and Ukraine inked a deal in Istanbul, which allows Kiev to resume Black Sea grain exports. Blockade of deliveries from the world's two biggest grain exporters hiked food prices worldwide, stoking fears of food insecurity. The Russia-Ukraine grain pact was meant to alleviate some of the global food concerns. Thanks for tuning in.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
Imam Hussein in the eyes of Sunni thinkers. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Imam Hussein's personality and movement has astounded every seeker of freedom from any creed. Many scholars and thinkers have spoken on Imam Hussein and the Epic of Ashura during the past 14 centuries. In a few episodes, we are going to dwell upon the words and views of four Sunni thinkers who love Hussein and have expressed their pure love in their works. Stay tuned, please. Abdurrahman al-Sharqawi was an Egyptian thinker, writer, journalist, poet, and dramatist. He was born in 1920 and was graduated in law in 1943. He worked as a lawyer for 2 years and then as an inspector for several years. This contemporary thinker then turned to writing dramas. Al-Sharqawi used to mix his dramas with poems. He wrote a piece on Imam Hussein, peace upon him, which was a brief account of the great epic of Ashura and the events after it. He has tried in the drama to express the political and social realities of his time and to show the way to resist against them. This way, he tries to make people understand the value of freedom and dignity. Al-Sharqawi believes that Imam Hussein, peace upon him, does not belong only to Shias, but to the whole mankind. He says, Hussein, peace upon him, is the martyr of religion and freedom. Not only Shias should be proud of him, but all free-spirited people in the world should take pride in his noble name. Al-Sharqawi was very successful in explicating Imam Hussein's personality and movement. He was among the Sunni writers who have conveyed the Imam's message beautifully to the reader. Perhaps one of the most beautiful parts of his dramas is related to the internal conflict of Hur, the commander of Ibn Ziyad's troops. Al-Sharqawi elaborately depicts Hur's verbal conflict with his senior commander, Umar Sa'd. Umar Sa'd asks him to stay without unsheathingly his sword. This way, he could keep his face among both groups. But Hur answers him that he couldn't serve two commanders and he wanted to choose between his conscience and his commander. The Egyptian thinker and dramatist Abdurrahman al-Sharqawi has tried in his poetical drama to show Imam Hussein's motive of his uprising against Yazid. He also tries to awaken his society through explicating Imam Hussein's character. He has versified some lines as if the Imam had told them. Part of his poems read, Remember me as you will find every virtue in me. I am the lonely who has been wronged. Now time has turned in a way that there remain only vices and praiseworthy virtues have perished. So remember me while courage has blended with idiocy and benefit has become the criterion for honesty and eloquent orators are like those who have failed to speak. When you behold silence against deception or witness submission to humility, do know that I will be beheaded again, and I will plunge in my blood thousands of times every day. Yes, they keep beheading me so long as a group is living in humility and disgrace. As long as a man like Yazid rules them and he does whatever he wishes, as long as the time is such, the martyr's wound will curse you as you have not learned his message. So reach the martyr's blood.
Food for thought.
Salam, friends. Let us begin the day by reflecting over what the martyr of Karbala, Imam Hussein, peace upon him, had said to the people of Kufa, who had invited him to come to Iraq to deliver them from Umayyad oppression. But because of their weak faith, they deserted him. If you will not hold on to your pledge of allegiance, break your covenant and throw off my pledge of allegiance, then by Allah, it is not the first time you do it. You did it with my father, Imam Ali, and you have done it with my brother, Imam Hassan, and my cousin, Muslim ibn Aqil.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is A to Z, an introduction into Husseini lifestyle. Today's lesson, the lifestyle of Imam Hussein. This Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome everyone. You're listening to A to Z from the IRB English Radio. I'm your host, Hussein Hinzano. I would like to send you my sincere condolences for the arrival of the month of Muharram and for the martyrdom anniversary of Al-Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wassalam. Now today, as we're talking about the lifestyle of Al-Imam Hussein, I would like to portray a few things of how he came to stand against the oppression that was happening during his time. The Holy Imam sallallahu alayhi wasallam saw that he was the only one responsible in the view of Allah, and it was solely his responsibility to bring about a revolution. At the time, there were so many oppressions happening. The tyrant rulers had done so much bad into the society that it was so difficult for anyone else to come and correct what had happened to the life of the people at the time. Now, and if Imam Hussein wouldn't have taken any steps against the wrong being continued by the ruling tyrants, who else could do that? So hence, Imam Hussein decided to express his aims that he wanted to remove the oppressions and the mischief and revive the enjoining of good and restraining from evil so that he could lead the people to truth and justice. All these aims of the Holy Imam were mentioned in his illuminated summons that he issued to the army forces comprised of Hur and soldiers of Ibn Ziyad. Imam Hussein is reported to be saying so many speeches that were aiming at making sure that people realize that now we are living in bad times of the tyrant rulers. The tyrant rulers are destroying our society. We need to stand against this. We need to take a stand against this particular time of period when we are being oppressed. We are being, the book of Allah is being stand against, and people are not believing in the words of the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wasallam. So the work of Imam Hussein was to stand against the oppression, was to stand against the mischief that was happening at the period, and to say no to the tyrant rulers.
Why is my heart set on fire when I hear your name?
As-salamu alayk, ya Aba Abdullah.
Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from the IRB English Radio, and we are talking about the lifestyle of Al-Imam Al-Hussein alayhi salam. How did Imam Al-Hussein get into the situation of fighting against the oppression at the time? It is said from his speech, one of his speeches, when he was saying one of his speeches to his companions, Imam Hussein said, "O people, the Messenger of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said, one who sees a tyrant ruler making the unlawful of Allah as lawful and ignoring the commands of Allah and opposing the practice of the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wasallam, committing before the very eyes of the people sins and transgressions, and he does not object to that, he does not object against him by words or action, it becomes incumbent on Allah to make him enter the same place that the very tyrant shall go in hell." Imam Hussein continued by saying, "All of them have obeyed the shaitan and they have become distant from the obedience of the beneficent. They have made corruption open and general. They have trespassed the limits and have took over public property in their sole control and have made the unlawful things lawful and the lawful things unlawful." These words of Imam Hussein's were expressing that people need to stand against the oppression. People need to stand against the unlawful tyrants, the bad tyrants at the time. They need to say no to them, because by keeping quiet on this, it will make you be like them. It will make you go have the same reward as they have. If they'll go to hell, we will go to hell. Imam Hussein is trying to tell his people, his companions, that you will go to hell if they will go to hell just because you didn't say anything. You didn't stand against the unlawful acts. It's upon us, it's upon every Muslim to stand against any unlawful acts that he's seeing in his life as the companions of Imam Hussein studied and learned from Ali Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Thank you so much for listening. We'll meet you in the next episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of A to Z. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page, where you can find all our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode and another lesson, fi amanillah, and God bless you all. Better friends than you, but anyone stay here won't be left tomorrow. You can save yourself tonight and go. A deep silence filled the air.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With the light.
Excited spectators gather at the Solberg Airport in the U.S. for the 39th New Jersey Lottery Festival of Ballooning.
We have about 45 balloons here today, including these spectacular special shapes. Our signature New Jersey Lottery Sunny Days balloon. You can see the tiger. Unicorn is hiding behind there. Tasmanian Devil, unique photo panda. We are having a spaceship. There's Billy the Kid. Spectacular presentation. You won't believe your skies this weekend.
Dozens of hot air balloons were test inflated in preparation for the real deal. The festival is considered the largest summertime event in New Jersey. Reddington City officials have predicted about 170,000 people will join the festival over the weekend. Weather forecasts say the skies are gentle enough for over 100 balloons to take flight in the morning and evening in mass ascents. And no one is more excited than the festival producer, who has been planning the event for months.
Including these spectacular special shapes. The balloons bring out the kid in everyone. You know, I've done this for a long time. This is the 39th annual one. But still, when I hear that propane whirring and these balloons going up, it makes the hair on my arm stand up.
The producer says these balloons will be handled by professional pilots and other balloons will be available for rides. The festival will last for 3 days, ending with food vendors, games, amusement rides, and other entertainment. There will also be a massive fireworks display, as well as a nighttime feature of glowing balloons. The annual festival is the largest seasonal hot air balloon festival in North America. It draws in thousands of visitors every year.
You might think twice about throwing out your old trainers after this story. A startup in Tunisia breathes new life into old shoes as artists restore and even customize the footwear. The new business is called Kenenti and is located in the capital, Tunis. Here, the team uses fabrics, laces, and leather recovered from various factories for the repair work. The creative artists work on every detail during each project, even the soles of the shoes. The work aims to find solutions to shoe waste and reuse items instead of adding them to the world's landfills. Cherif Zeroui is the co-founder of Kenenti. He says the idea came to him 2 years ago when he discovered the number of shoes thrown away each year in Tunisia.
Of
In France, there were 100 million pairs of shoes thrown away every year. This is a huge figure for us, and for the ecosystem and for the earth. In Tunisia, it's almost the same, given the population. There were 3 or 4 million shoes thrown away every year. So we thought of giving added value to these shoes, so we restored them.
Zerbouy also says he is happy to create jobs for those willing to participate regardless of the educational degree. Besides shoes, these artists dabble in restoring worn-out handbags, giving them a brand new look. Many of the artists and interns say they are proud to be part of this unique project. They say they feel like a family there. The startup is the first trainer restoration business to be launched in North America. Would you buy a pair of scrap tire sandals? Well, in the Vietnamese capital, Hanoi, you will find all kinds of handmade sandals from recycled tires. The famously rugged footwear of the Viet Cong have traveled vast distances over the decades. Shoemakers use sharp knives and chisels to craft a sandal from huge tires. For those seeking a nod to yesteryear, the hard-sole sandals are available at markets and small stores alike, with prices ranging from $2,000 to $1,000. The Vietnamese first began making rubber sandals in the late 1940s during the first Indochina War against the French, using tires from ambushed army trucks. They found the sandals were cheap to make and survive well in wet, muddy and hilly conditions. Even in peacetime, the design remains popular for sustainability reasons. Living through a pandemic is strange, as we are often locked indoors, but a UK-based Indian mechanical engineer made the best use of his time during the coronavirus lockdown and built an airplane. 38-year-old Ashok Ali Serial, who is also a private pilot, had long dreamt of a personal aircraft. He initially planned to order an aircraft kit and built it with his colleagues, but he says the 2020 lockdown left him with no choice but to complete it on his own. Now he has an aircraft which he has named after his youngest daughter, Dia. The plane can carry up to 4 people, including the pilot, and fly about 250 kilometers an hour. After getting clearance to fly, he flew across 4 European countries with his friends. He has also gone on a trip with his family of 4.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Some gardens are decorated with genomes and other cute ornaments, but this garden uses tank debris to stand out amongst others. The intention of the gardener isn't to have the most army-themed patch. Valeria tried to remove the tank, but ultimately, because of its size and weight, it was impossible. So he just let it stay. The owner says he is used to having the tank there, even though it reminds him of hard times. Next to the wreckage, this family has planted cabbage and potatoes, which they harvest and use each year. The tank was left over from the war between Russia and Ukraine that began earlier this year. British paleontologists have made an exciting fossil discovery, which has been identified as the earliest known animal predator.
It's quite a large fossil. It's the preserved part is at least 20 centimetres tall, and it would have lived attached to the seafloor bottom. But it's a broken specimen, so we actually don't know how large the entire colony is. This is only a fragment of it.
Wilby says the animal had a stalk and a cup on top with little tentacles, which most likely used to catch food out of the water. The ancient animal is related to sea anemones, jellyfish and corals, and pushes the known existence of these species back to 20 million years. Wilby explains the fossil displays a key point in the evolution of animal. The fossil is said to be around 560 million years old and was discovered in Charnwood Forest, northern England, amongst over 1,000 other fossils.
Summer heat is here, and zoos are working to not only keep visitors cool, but animals safe during the hot weather. A Belgian zoo takes extra precautions to help animals survive a fierce heat wave that has left Western Europe sweltering. A Pairi d'Aiza zoo, located in Wallonia in the province of Hainaut, provides animals with frozen food, fruit suspended in water, and extra showers. It has also created extra shaded areas with good ventilation along with water points to ensure animals have access to them. Zookeepers say managing animals in high temperatures requires good forward planning. Zoos across the world have a variety of responses to keep animals cool, so we humans are not the only creatures who feel significant stress during the hot months. Animals, too, are impacted by it.
Iran's city of Rafsanjan has hosted an international talent contest dubbed Stage Stars. The event is aimed at providing a chance for stage talents from across the world to come in the spotlight. Yusuf Jalali reports from Rafsanjan. Let's check it out.
This is a global stage for talents. The fifth International Stage Stars Festival wrapped up with the announcement of winners, who have been competing in four categories of singing, voice acting, show hosting, and sound impression. The top performances from each category won the golden mic and a cash prize.
The festival was a place for more serious competition between those who have a say in a stage performance. I'm so happy to be chosen by the jury as the best show host of the contest.
It was an amazing event for talents. I'm so glad to be part of this. Talents from all across Iran and many parts of the world competed in the festival, so winners should be proud of themselves.
Held in Iran's city of Rafsanjan, the two-day event brought together participants from 14 countries, including Iran, Afghanistan, Kyrgyzstan, Nigeria, and Turkey, to flaunt their knack for stage performance.
The scale of this contest is global. Many of us participants did not have any idea we could be stand-up comedians or show hosts. But when we got on stage here, we ourselves discovered our own talents.
I really love that, seeing that all people around the world are coming here and presenting themselves. It's a very great feeling. Of course, they will be progressed and they will develop yourself when they will got the result.
The jury is comprised of top Iranian actors, TV presenters, and voice artists. They say the competition has been tough, and those who stood out are real stage stars.
We tried our best to pick talents who really acted like professionals on stage. Not only should they care about the standards and principles of a stage performance, but they must innovate, improvise, and stand out.
This festival acted like a university for stage talents. It taught a lot of lessons about the stage to participants, especially for those who failed to win the contest.
Organizers say this contest is not just about scouting for stage talents. They say the event helps shine a spotlight on talents and lead them to their community.
The fifth Stage Stars Festival is aimed at bringing stage talents to light. Many of the participants already have a few years of experience, so this stage is not supposed to discover them, but to springboard them to a higher level in their careers.
All of the contestants, even those who come from foreign countries, must perform in Persian. However, organizers plan to include other languages in the upcoming editions of the festival.
To those who won the Golden Mic here, this is a dream come true. But they say, aside from the prize, Stage Stars has marked a milestone in their pursuit of success, since they have now come under the spotlight. Yusuf Jalali from the city of Rafsanjan.
Age is just a number when it comes to pursuing your goals. That's what 98-year-old Italian man Giuseppe Paterno has proven. Paterno has become the oldest university graduate in his country for the second time. In July 2020, he was graduated in history and philosophy from the University of Palermo. 2 years on, he's now got a master's degree in the same subjects. Paterno grew in a poor family in Sicily and always had a desire for learning. But he was unable to go to university at a young age. He finished high school aged 31, 6 years after he got married. Paterno's love to study or for study never stopped, making him enter the university in his 90s.
تانيك ناديك ليش تأخر عباس من البيان يا حسين من زوري وشاف الراس تانيك ناديك ليش تأخر عباس
Mournful is the earth as heaven starts to cry, water doubts its worth as lips begin to dry. Listen to the silence. It breaks with a sad goodbye amid the drums of war is a mother's lullaby. Hussein, Hussein, Hussein. Hussein, Hussein, Hussein. Hussein, Hussein, Hussein. I cry for you in pain. I cry for you. I cry for you in
pain. In the limelight.
While candidates are free to challenge the results of their elections under various state guidelines, Trump-allied election officials pose a more insidious threat. Echoing the same false narratives as Donald Trump and his endorsed candidates, county officials in New Mexico, Nevada, and Pennsylvania have tried to circumvent state laws and refused to sign off on primary election results. We have prepared for you an article written by Igor Derish, a New York-based political writer. The piece is titled, GOP Officials in at least 3 States Have Refused to Certify Primary Results. Please stay with us for more of Igor Derish's article. U.S. Republican election officials in at least three states have refused to certify primary votes in a sign of things to come amid the party's baseless election fraud crusade. Numerous allies of former President Donald Trump have echoed his lies about voter fraud on the campaign trail. Trump-backed Arizona gubernatorial candidate Kerry Lake and Nevada U.S. Senate candidate Adam Laxalt both claimed evidence of election stealing before any votes were cast. Colorado Secretary of State candidate Tina Peters has twice demanded recounts of her Republican primary race after losing by double digits. Nevada gubernatorial candidate Joey Gilbert filed a lawsuit alleging that his GOP primary loss was a mathematical impossibility, even after a recount he requested confirmed the results. While candidates are free to challenge the results of their elections under various state guidelines, Trump-allied election officials pose a more insidious threat. Echoing the same false narratives as Donald Trump and his endorsed candidates, county officials in New Mexico, Nevada, and Pennsylvania have tried to circumvent state laws and refused to sign off on primary results. Republican commissioners in Otero County, New Mexico, recently refused to certify primary results in their GOP-dominated jurisdiction, citing unspecified concerns about Dominion voting machines. These apparently stem from Trump World's crusade to stoke allegations that the machines had flipped votes from Trump to Joe Biden. The Otero County commissioners ultimately relented and certified the votes amid concerns that they could go to jail after state officials took them to court. Republican commissioners in rural Esmeralda County in Nevada likewise refused to certify the 317 votes cast in the county recently, citing unspecified concerns about the election from residents. County officials ultimately relented after spending more than 7 hours counting the 317 ballots by hand. Three Republican-led counties in Pennsylvania, Berks, Fayette, and Lancaster, have refused to count all valid votes from the May 17th primary election for Senate, Congress, Governor, and the state legislature for weeks over opposition to the state's rules regarding undated mail-in ballots. According to the Associated Press, officials in all three counties informed the state last month that they would not count mail-in votes that had not been properly dated. Pennsylvania mail ballots instruct voters to write a date next to their signature on the outside of mail-in return envelopes, although these dates do not determine whether voters are eligible or if votes were cast on time. A federal appeals court ruled in May that undated mail-in ballots must be counted, ruling that the dates are immaterial. Recently, the U.S. Supreme Court, even with three Trump-appointed justices, allowed the ruling to stand. A state court similarly ruled in the Republican Senate primary that undated ballots should be counted. The Pennsylvania Department of State earlier this month sued the three counties, asking a state court to order them to include all valid ballots, even if the voter failed to write a date